Tonight is July 4th, 2004, and the Sunday night speaker meeting of Narcotics Anonymous would like to welcome our first speaker, Ted.
Thanks, Jim. I'm Ted, and I'm an addict. And it's good to be here. Grateful for the meeting. And to see all of you. You know, when Jim asked me to share, and it didn't occur to me that the 4th of July was such a big deal, not being an American and having not been here for very long, and I said to him, I accused him of just choosing a foreigner because no one else would do it. So, I'm happy to be here, and you know, it's a holiday, but it's just another day in my recovery, and that's pretty much how I have to look at it, and it's pretty much a day at a time that's got me here. You know, I'm concerned about the fact that you know, that I can speak for half an hour about my recovery. I can speak for half an hour about almost anything else, but when I start talking about my recovery, I tend to get all kinds of hung up on what I don't know rather than what I do. And so I guess I'll start by just telling you a little bit about myself. I'm from a place called New Zealand, and I've been in LA for about 2 years. I grew up in a city of about a million people with an older brother and an older sister, and my earliest memories of childhood, I think, are the fact that I was the youngest in a family of three, and that my brother and sister were very much older than me. My brother was 10 years older than me, my sister was like 12 years older than me. And my earliest memories were of feeling like our family history had already been written, and that I wasn't really part of it. And that what had happened was that my family had just developed on its own, and I'd just come along later and didn't really fit somehow. And I knew that there was kind of turmoil that existed in my family. I knew that there was conflict between my brother and my father, and I saw that. And I saw that my father drank, you know, and that I have memories of him. He was a journalist, and he was a sports journalist, and he was the editor of the local, or of the national newspaper, actually, sports department. His specialty was racing, so he would travel around the country going to race meetings, you know. And every Saturday was a race meeting, and it might be, you know, an 8-hour drive or a 5-hour drive. And I didn't know much about the races when I was a kid, but I did know that there was a lot of alcohol at the races, because my dad would come home from the races, and it wasn't uncommon for the car to stop and for him not to get out for a long time. And a lot of the reason for that, I discovered later, was that he would make it home and then he would pass out. And if he did make it inside, you know, that was something to dread as well, because that would often end in some kind of argument, usually between him and mum. So there was kind of a system that developed in my family, and that was that we did as much as we could to appease my father and to make sure that that he didn't get angry with us, or he didn't punish us in some way. And one of his mechanisms was that he would not talk for days on end, you know, and he would get angry about something, and he just wouldn't talk about it, and he wouldn't talk to anybody, period. So you know, I got very resentful about my father, and I kind of took on my brother, my older brother, as a male role model. You know, he was the guy in my life I most wanted to be like. And the main flaw in that was that my brother was a using addict and budding criminal. And you know, so I had all these confusing kind of things going on. By the time I got to be like 10 years old, my brother and sister not only left home, but they left to go overseas. I remember that, like, vividly. I remember being really upset, especially my sister went first and then my brother, and I felt totally abandoned because, you know, in a little country like that that's so far away from the rest of the world, one of the things people do is they leave and they travel, you know, and it's almost kind of, it's an accepted thing to do, you know, they call it doing your OE, which stands for overseas experience, and people just take off. Quite often they go to England because you can go there, you know. But that was really upsetting for me, and I felt like my brother and my sister were kind of surrogate parents in some way. They filled that kind of role. I didn't feel close to my father for the reasons that I've already spoken about, and I was really conflicted about my mother, because although I felt close to her, and she would complain about my father, but would always default to his defense. And you know, I've learned, you know, as an adult, the reasons for that kind of thing, and I know about codependency and how a codependent parent, you know, will appease the alcoholic and that kind of thing. And I understand more my role in that kind of thing, but at the time it was really difficult for me, and it had a big impact on my formative years, on my teenage years, and I remember, you know, I remember being 10 years old and crying and holding on to my brother and sister's possessions and listening to their records and doing whatever I could, because I felt so alone in that place, in that house, and I felt like my parents were like the same age as everyone else's grandparents. And you know, I felt very different and very uncomfortable. And there was always a lot of alcohol around my house, so at about the age of probably 10, I had my first drink. And you know, we've heard it all before, and the same goes for me, that I felt like, you know, I felt like I had gotten something. I felt like I had found a way out, you know, if not temporarily. And you know, so I began to do that as much as possible, and to change the way I felt as much as possible. And I did other things to change the way I felt. It's not like I started drinking and was able to do that all the time, or to smoke or whatever. I read books. I lived in a kind of fantasy world. I was very much kind of a loner, you know. I created these whole kind of fantasy situations and life for myself, and I had imaginary friends and, you know, all that kind of thing. But at the root of that all was a lot of pain. I just felt at odds with everything. I felt like I was rubbing against the universe. And as I got older, I discovered that the more often that I could lay my hands on something that changed the way I felt, the more often I could feel like I was okay with everything, you know, for a little while. By the time I was 12 or 13, I was using drugs on a regular basis. It affected my whole schooling. My high school years were totally affected by my drug use. I was in what we call, I don't know if you have them here, but what we call top stream classes, which means that you sit certain tests when you're at one school, and you go on to the next school, and they put you in a certain kind of class. It's supposed to be based on your intelligence and your achievement. And you know, it started out that I could always get into those classes, and they always kept putting me in them. But what happened as I got through high school is I was consistently, you know, the worst pupil in the best class. And you know, I remember my father coming to my school once and like talking to my principal about my bad results, and kind of blaming the school system for my bad results. You know, there was always this theme of avoidance in my family. Like, you never really talked about what was going on. You talked around what was going on. You know, there always had to be a reason that wasn't to do with the shocking truth, whatever that might be. You know, and in my family, it was usually drugs and alcohol. And So my career developed, you know, by the time I was in my 20s, I'd kind of, well, by the time I was ready to leave high school, I was pretty much a fully fledged lousy drug user. You know, I wasn't any good at it, but I couldn't stop doing it, and it progressed. And every time I felt that the pain of life was too much, or that that the world was far too hostile for me to deal with, I would kind of take on a new leg of my addiction, you know. And like it says in our literature, it was progressive, and it eventually brought me to my knees on more than one occasion. And you know, I'm a musician, that's what I do, and I'd chosen by the time I was about 18 that that's what I was going to do, and I started playing in bands at an early age, and I made records, and I had some success in my country, and won some awards, and but for me, it was carte blanche to use drugs. You know, I found the best profession in the world for a drug addict. You know, they say that the best profession in the world for an alcoholic is a traveling salesman. I've heard that. You know, but one of the best professions for a drug addict is rock and roll, because you know, people want to give you drugs, and it's about drugs, and you know, and the powers that be. There's a degree of acceptability. You know, you can, as long as you're not totally passed out, you know, it's usually okay. And so, you know, sometimes in hindsight, I've wondered about that whole chicken and egg situation. You know, whether I chose the career, whether I chose the drugs, you know, to fit in, chose a career that fitted the lifestyle. And I guess that's been answered, because I still do it, and I've been clean for 4 years now. So, you know, when I got clean, one of my biggest worries was that I wouldn't be able to do it anymore. And I'd kind of come to a decision in my first 6 months of being clean that I couldn't play music anymore, that it was like too much of a minefield, and I couldn't do it. And what happened was that, you know, as it tends to around here, the decision seemed to be taken care of for me, and I ended up playing music again. And, you know, that first year for me was very difficult, and I really didn't know whether I wanted to be here. You know, the first three steps for me were really, you know, they contained all kinds of things. When I first saw them on the wall of the place where I did treatment, I you know, the things that popped out of me were powerlessness. You know, I didn't like the sound of that. I didn't like the sound of making any kind of decision, you know, because, you know, I hadn't decided whether I wanted to stop using, really. I wanted a break from having a drug habit, a physical habit. But I didn't know that that addiction wasn't just a physical habit. I thought that, you know, having a habit and kicking, that's what addiction was. I didn't realize that that this was a disease, and that there was a way of treating it. And so, you know, it was like I say, it was difficult for me to come to terms with some of that stuff. And it was a slow process. You know, I still wanted to have some back doors open. I still wanted to be able to smoke dope. I didn't think that pot was a drug. I couldn't really see it, you know. And I didn't really drink at that time, but, you know, I suddenly had fantasies of civilized drinking, you know. And I thought, you know, I railed against this thing called recovery and its the injustices, you know, the fact that I couldn't do certain things again that I didn't consider I had a problem with, you know. So I didn't really get it, and it slowly started to gel for me, and that happened by coming around here and just coming back, you know, just coming back to meetings. My first year, I didn't know what else to do. You know, I've got enough of this to know that it was either this or go back to what I had before, you know. And so I just kept coming around, you know. I remember my first living situation when I got clean was this old house, and it was really close to where I did treatment. And I would just get up and walk in the middle of the night, you know. I'd just have to leave and just take to the streets, and I'd walk for hours because I just didn't know what else to do. Or I would just go out and just keep moving until there was a meeting to go to. And you know, we have at home, we have 10 meetings a week probably. So you know, you don't have that luxury of going to a morning meeting or a lunch